6:03 p.m. on, what's this, the 4th of April, 2011, the 6 o'clock segment of House Finance Committee to take up one bill, and that being House Bill 80 that was previously heard back during the month of February during we have kept open public testimony anticipating this glorious night when the basketball game is going on. But sorry for my planning, but 90 days, we triage some things. That we have met members present, Representative Wilson, Representative Guttenberg, Representative Kirchhoff, Representative Guerra, Representative Costello, and Representative Dugan. And with us to make a brief presentation of the bill, which was previously presented, Mr. Shattuck, and will help us direct traffic for anybody else here that's to assist you in your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name, for the record, my name is Rex Shattuck, staff to Representative Newman, who is the sponsor of HB 80. We should have available for any questions, Mr. Brian Judy, who might help in answering any questions on this bill. A quick summary or recap. Mr. Chair, thank you very much for allowing us to present this bill to the committee. HB 80 addresses a concern that Alaska statutes do not protect the rights of individual Alaskans to defend themselves. Prior to filing this legislation, Representative Newman, the sponsor, received a number of contacts from constituents with regard to existing state law that specifies, quote, an individual has a duty to retreat when he or she knows it can be achieved safely. Researching the issue, we found that Alaska was not alone. In fact, 18 other states had found similar deficiencies in their statutes, and likewise attempting to clarify that the citizen had a right to defend themselves in a place where they had a right to be. We also found organizations like the National Rifle Association or NRA were engaged in this issue. The effect of this legislation is not only to act as a deterrent to the criminal element, but also make clear to individual Alaskans, law enforcement, and the courts that one does indeed have a right to defend oneself in any place that you have a right to be. Real quickly, it is a two-page bill. It is addressing existing statute, Section 1, AS 1181-335B is amended to read on page 2, line 3, in any place where the person has a right to be. As I stated, there are a number of states who have likewise in the past had statements that required an individual to flee when they could do so safely. The language is very similar in most of those states, and our choice to clarify that in 5 is just to say in any place where the person has a right to be.
Thank you. And I also note one that says prime sponsorship. Representative Costello is also a prime sponsor of the bill. Must have been introduced early. Yep. Pre-file. Did you have anybody else you wish to augment your testimony?
If Mr. Brian Judy was online, if it pleases the chair, we'd like to invite him to comment on the legislation as well.
Mr. Judy, are you online?
Can you hear me, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir. Go ahead and identify yourself for the record and provide us with your testimony.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Brian Judy. I am the Alaska State Liaison for the National Rifle Association Institute for Legislative Action, and I am testifying this evening in strong support of House Bill 80. This bill is important self-defense legislation that would provide that a law-abiding citizen, law-abiding individual who is justified in using deadly force has no duty to retreat from an attack if the person is in any place that person has a legal right to be. And I want to emphasize that point. This is a very narrow bill. It only applies to a person who has justification to use deadly force. Existing Alaska law already provides, that there is no duty to retreat, again, if a person is justified, if that person is on premises that the person owns or leases, where the person resides, or if it's at a place where the person works. anything outside those limited locations, if a person knows that he or she can safely retreat from an encounter, the person is legally required to do so. So, again, there are two considerations that have to go through an individual's mind when that person is facing a threat. The secondary consideration that this bill is modifying is the duty to retreat. And again, notwithstanding the question of retreat, a person who's using deadly force in self-defense must be justified. And this is that's the primary consideration. And this bill in no way changes that. So what I want to do is I want to take a minute and just go through for the committee what constitutes justification to use deadly force. You may hear some opposition that talks about gangs and you know, the promotion of violence and things that this bill concerns and fears that this bill might raise. And I want to try to allay those right off the bat by going through what's required for an individual to be justified in using deadly force. A person has to reasonably believe that it's necessary for self-defense against what the person reasonably believes to be the unlawful use of force, which would lead to death, serious physical injury, kidnapping, sexual assault, or robbery. So only in these limited circumstances, only when the person, when a reasonable person, and there's the objective standard of reasonableness, it's not random, and it's very likely that these cases are going to be looked at by a jury, and then calm, cool, collective time of a situation in a courtroom, quite different from the four-second life or death decision-making process, but only if a reasonable person believes that a threat is going to result in these very serious outcomes, is a person justified in using deadly force. And existing Alaska law also lays out specifically what cannot be used or in what circumstances the justification cannot be claimed. And there are generally four. If the individual is engaged in mutual combat, if the individual is the initial aggressor of a conflict, if an individual provoked the other's conduct, or if the individual is involved in felonious activity or in gang activity as laid out in the Alaska Code. So in any of those circumstances, specifically, justification cannot be claimed. So again, only in those very narrow circumstances where an individual is justified in using deadly force does the question of a retreat even come into play. So if you remove the additional question, this whole question of retreat with complete safety, what you're doing is you're removing one more thing that a potential victim must concern herself in that life or death split-second decision-making process. Again, removing the duty of retreat is going to in no way change the fact that the person must be justified to use deadly force and now, must be lawfully, already as an existing law, must be lawfully in the place where the act of self-defense takes place. But now, outside those limited, home, property, business, now if there's any place a person is legally, if you're trespassing, this doesn't come into play. You have to be legally in the place. So to look at it this way, right now, a person who resists an aggressor bears the risk of a finding that although the response, there's justification, and the response was proportional to the reasonably perceived threat, if the person overestimates violence. And again, I would dispute that, because it's only in those cases where an individual is clearly justified. That's the only time when the question of retreat is going to come up. We've heard that there should be respect for human life. We need to err on the side of life. And the NRA would suggest that the whole sanctity of life issues are somewhat less compelling in circumstances where the person whose life was taken was behaving in such a way that the person who took the life reasonably, emphasize that legal standard, reasonably feared being raped or killed. A rapist isn't deterred by rape laws, but the hesitation of his law-abiding victim to employ defensive force may mean the difference for her between life and death. So the whole sanctity of life issue cuts both ways. The bottom line is, victims should have the protection of law, not criminals. Law-abiding citizens should not have to fear criminal prosecution when they're in a place they have a legal right to be, where they're justified in using deadly force, and they stand their ground and defend themselves without retreating. So I'd be happy to answer any questions, but I just urge your support for House Bill 80. Thank you.
Questions for Mr. Judy?
Thank you very much, Mr. Judy.
You're welcome to hang online and listen to proceedings. We have next signed up, I believe maybe for questions, Quinlan Steiner. Are you with us, Mr. Steiner?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. This is Quinlan Steiner. I'm the public defender for the state of Alaska, and I'm just available for questions.
Very good. Any questions? I assume you're going to hang on line in case some come up later.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. I'm not sure which location they're in. That's an off-net. Bill Pinney?
Yes, sir.
Please go ahead and identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm William Pinney. I had an incident that occurred to me that could have put me in a problem that would have been in conflict with the current law. I will explain what happened. On November 27, 2010, I was at Home Depot off Pendleton Parkway leaving the store. As I headed south, approaching the light at Pendleton Parkway, there was a car behind me. As I approached the light, turning red, I stopped approximately 4 feet from the line of the crosswalk. I was in the middle lane that was allowed to go either straight or turn left, with a right turn lane only to my right. The entry lane was on my left to Rodeo Place. I was the first vehicle in line. While stopped, an older model, very dirty pickup, possibly blue or gray, not American-made, was westbound on Pendleton Parkway and turned directly in front of me, going the wrong direction in traffic up against my front bumper, leaving no room between my vehicle and the other pickup. The person in the vehicle appeared to be yelling and making gestures at me. A man stepped out of the vehicle. At first, he appeared older, with a pockmarked face, with sores, and his teeth looked very bad. He was wearing a dark-colored jacket, dark pants, and a hat with a racing emblem on it. In retrospect, medical and police personnel tell me this is a classic sign of drug use and most likely methamphetamine use. I could tell he was yelling profanities, and I could not understand all that he was saying for sure while inside my vehicle. At this point, I was in a very bad spot. I was unable to retreat in any way while in my truck, also having another car behind me and his vehicle too close enough to the front of my vehicle that a person couldn't get between the two vehicles. I had to try and disarm the problem. If I had tried to run away with the road very icy, I could have fallen and put myself in a much larger problem. So retreat was not a viable option. I stepped out of my vehicle, staying behind the door, and tried to explain I could not back up due to the vehicle behind me, and if he would please move just a little, I'd move out of his way. The man continued yelling profanities, saying he would teach me to stay out of the effing way. I did not know how to effing drive. I should not be allowed to effing drive. I was in the wrong effing lane, you effing something.
And we're getting the point on the adjectives there, and I understand that.
Okay, I wrote this out exactly as it translates.
I appreciate the historical accuracy, but we're on a public record here, too.
Okay. He turned and reached into his vehicle and produced a wooden baseball bat. He started coming forward, and apparently seeing he could not get between the vehicle, he went around the back of his vehicle. At this point, I understood this was going way beyond talking. I am a concealed carry permit person. I drew my weapon to a low guard position, staying behind my truck door and not allowing the weapon to be seen in case I could get out of this mess. As he rounded the back of the vehicle, I told him to stop three separate times, that he was threatening my life with a weapon and don't take another step. His response was, I could not stop him and I'm going to beat you to death. By this point, he was about to come even with the front of my truck. In my training, this is closer than an assailant is allowed to get. With the road very icy, I knew he could not get to me fast without falling. I repeated my demand for him to stop, understanding this was my last chance to get out of this. He continued, and I stepped out from behind the door and raised the weapon to fire. At this point, he stopped, and I believe he viewed the weapon and understood that if he came any closer, I would stop him. He turned around back into his vehicle and departed east on Penland Parkway. This all took place in less than 2 minutes. I returned to my vehicle and left the area. When CCW laws was passed, people said we would have gunfights in the street because people carrying weapons. This did not happen in this state or other states that have done the same. When the initial Castle Doctrine was passed here in Alaska, the states and other states, again, people would say it's going to promote gunfights in the street. Once again, this has not been the case. This proposed legislation would simply protect people anywhere they are legally allowed to be and not have to retreat in most cases, places people would place people in greater danger trying to get away. In every state these laws have been put in place, the crime rate has gone down by FBI statistics. That's the end of what I have. If you have any questions, I'll be glad to answer them.
Any questions for Mr. Penny?
I do, Mr. Chair.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you. Sir, it sounds like a harrowing experience. It sounds like you handled it right. But, you know, there's sometimes we deal with perceptions of bills that are different than what the bill actually does. And under the laws as it exists right now, you are completely entitled to do what you did because you had no ability to get out of the way. And the law says that if you can't retreat without complete personal safety, you don't have to. So you did what you were legally entitled to do. This bill doesn't change anything. So I think sometimes the current law is not understood by folks, but there's no duty to retreat unless you can do it with what's called complete personal safety.
I agree with you, Mr. Guerra. The only thing being is if that car hadn't been behind me, it still wouldn't have made sense to try and retreat the way, you know, if he had come after me, and if he was indeed a druggie, I would have been still in a bad situation. But you just, you know, you could meet these people anywhere, I believe.
Thank you, sir, and I'm glad that you ended up safe out of the situation. Like I said, it sounded pretty harrowing.
So. Can't quite hear him.
What I said was I'm glad you ended up safe. It sounds like an awful situation. Thank you.
Well, I did the best I could.
Thank you very much, Mr. Penny. Is Mr. Nelson there?
Affirmative, sir.
Go ahead and identify yourself similarly and present your testimony, sir.
Thank you all. I'm just coming out of a group I'm working at the moment. That's why I just came dutching in here. My name is Bob Nelson. I was in the Army for 30 years. I now work for a mental health agency in town. I'm a psychotherapist by trade. I'm a master's level with questions beyond that. My thought about talking tonight is this. On Monday, February 15th, my wife and I stopped at the Carr's grocery store down the corner of Muldoon and Northern Lights here in Anchorage. And there was a young man in there being extremely profane, hollering F-U, 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 and making obscene gestures with both hands, and I asked him basically to stop. There were women and families there. He continued to repeat the same phrases, so I got up and tried talking with the young man. Be a gentleman, please take it outside. This has all been verified by the police department. He got up and advanced towards me, and I moved closer and asked him, keeping my voice down, asked him to be a gentleman again, take it outside. As I'm talking, I'm moving towards the door. He followed with me, and I hung back, but I didn't want him to feel pressured in this entire thing. The bottom line was that as we hit the door, he was a couple of steps in front of me. I stopped and started turning around, and he turned around and hit me. Hit me over a dozen times in the head. I was knocked down. Severe injuries, about the only way to say it. My problem was this, that I'm trying to be the psychotherapist in a non-psychotherapical world. I'm trying to be the guy that backs off and the guy that tries to be understanding in a non-understanding world. And what I've learned from this entire thing is that you can be a victim anywhere at any time. I've had four surgeries. I've lost over 2.5 months of work. I have two more surgeries pending. The gentleman that assaulted me was given 4 years in jail, 2 years suspended, and I got notified 2 weeks ago by Vine that he is now in a halfway house. I'm still into therapy. I will never be the same. I have a mild brain injury out of this entire thing. I'm still being treated by a pathologist. I'm being treated by a psychologist. I'm treated by a psychiatrist for the various issues that I've come up with. What I've learned from this entire thing is that I will never back down again. In the Army for 30 years, I served 2 tours in Vietnam. I was in Desert Shield and Desert Storm. I was never injured. It took basically being home where I was supposed to be safe to be wounded, and as a result, I vowed never to back down again. This spring, my wife and I and my daughter will be taking a concealed carry course, and I'm tired of being the victim of parasites and by the system that's supposed to support me. The court system did not support me through this entire thing. My victim's rights were abridged through the entire process. As a family, we're very responsible. We've served our country. We've served our state and our city. We've served on committees. We're active in our church. We've been foster parents for over 450 children, and we've raised 4 biological sons and 5 adopted daughters. 3 of the sons have completed college, as have 3 of the daughters. 1 daughter is a freshman at UAA, and the last daughter is looking with a smile. She has special needs. We adopted her. None of those kids have been in trouble, and all but the last, the 15-year-old, are independent. My assailant, however, was working on his 3rd minor consuming charge at age 19, and we tried to get a 3rd person to bring him out of jail, which was his mother. She had a longer record than he did. But yet I'm the law-abiding one. Yet I'm the one that's gone through all the surgeries. Yet I'm the one that's still being treated today. He'll get out, and he'll be free on the street again. I will never back down again.
Thank you very much, Mr. Nelson. Any questions for Mr. Nelson? We have also off net Nick Herrera.
Yes, sir. Nick Herrera. I'm in a similar situation. I served in the Army for 23 years protecting this country of ours. And although I've not experienced the same situation here in Alaska, having fought for this country and served it, we do live in a world where a lot of elements in this world of ours have chosen a path of crime, and it's incumbent on us to protect those and the rights that were given to us by God and to protect ourselves, our family, and our fellow man. And although the right to retreat is already protected under current laws, I believe that House Bill 80 is going to go on to further strengthen that, so that a lot of the examples that you're hearing about where there's good law-abiding American citizens who are supporting their communities don't have to question when they, where a situation of life and death may come up at any given moment, and they have to question whether they should or shouldn't back down, and they make the right or wrong decision. All this does is strengthen it for them. I've never, ever taken the right to use deadly force lightly, and again, would only take it as a last resort, and if I deem it necessary and protect myself or others around me. So it's not something that I or anybody else should ever take lightly, nor will take lightly, but again, I think this House bill is going to give us strength and empower us against those who've chosen to not serve us in this community of ours. That's all I have. Thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Herrera? Thank you, sir, for your testimony and for coming out tonight. Do we have anybody else online? How about here in Juneau?
we'll take this still a little bit early in testimony. We'll take about a 15-minute at ease and come back and see if some other folks are signed up. I don't want to leave too early. Representative Guerra?
Sure, maybe we did. Did we ever hear from the Department of Law on this? I think we did. I'm not sure.
No.
I guess I wouldn't mind.
We can take that if Ms. Carpinetti would like to come forward. Yeah, Mr. Shattuck, do you have a count? I've lost count of how many emails I've gotten on this. Have you? And I know we all get different emails. But
I think the last count that we were aware of was just short of 80.
I was going to say, so,
which was going to be my comment in the round.
House Bill 80 on 80.
80 on 80.
Welcome, Ms. Carpinetti.
My name is Annie Carpinetti, and I represent the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. I think we have testimony on this bill. We do not have a position on this bill. I thought I was coming here tonight to talk about the fiscal note that we have. But I will say what I think may be a common misconception of our current law is that I've heard people testify that it's not fair to ask a citizen in a frightening, scary situation to make a choice when they're under pressure about whether or not to defend themselves. Our law doesn't really require you to do that. Our law only requires you to retreat when you know that you can do so in perfect safety to yourself and to others. So our law doesn't ask you to make a split-second decision and be afraid that you might be charged with a crime. We don't charge people who are in those situations. And that may be helpful in looking at this bill. In other cases, you know, I'm happy to talk about our fiscal notes or answer any questions you have.
Questions? Representative Wilson?
Thank you, sir. So if we already have that and we have an indeterminate fiscal note, just in the past couple of years, how many people do you think may have fallen underneath this new statute?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilson, we think that a lot of people who are charged with homicide and serious assaults would possibly, and we don't know for sure, that's the problem, would pursue a self-defense defense, which is that otherwise would not be able to under our current law.
Follow up, sir.
Representative Wilson.
But you just testified that the bill really doesn't do anything that you can't already do. I mean, if you already feel like you're in danger and you do that, you would be underneath self-defense. So I don't understand why, if that's how people felt already, they wouldn't go ahead and claim it. I don't see how this bill would make it any different.
Through the chair, our law presently does not require a person to retreat unless he or she believes that he or she can do so in complete safety. This bill would allow a person to use deadly force without any duty to retreat as long as they are justified in using deadly force. There's the difference. So we are concerned that people who, and I really think we in the prosecution world, we look at this through different glasses, really different lenses than from, I mean, in this room, we all think about ourselves as people using this force, as reasonable people who wouldn't take life for granted. But in the prosecution world, we look at people who are charged with homicides and with drug offenses and with gang-related offenses that, you know, don't necessarily have that same respect for human life that most people in this room, I mean, everybody in this room does. So we look at it in such a different way than you look at it, because we look at it as, oh, this is going to be a gang fight and we're going to have to disprove, and because the prosecution does have to disprove this defense beyond a reasonable doubt. So we think there will be more people who will claim self-defense and that we won't win them all.
Mr. Chair, but I don't hear numbers, but yet I see a fiscal note that says that you're going to need two more full-time people. So you must have some number in mind of those you think will utilize this law, whether it's in the right man or not.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilson, our most recent fiscal note has been an indeterminate fiscal note because it is hard to justify. It's hard to figure out how many people this would apply to. That so it is difficult for us to say how much it will cost. We think it will more people will claim self-defense, which means that prosecutions will be harder. But we don't know.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It just a lot of states are doing the same thing, so obviously the public must not feel the same way.
Ms. Carpenter, do you think you have the similar issue we're in an environment here where we're not dealing on a daily basis with criminals and drug dealers and so forth. Sometimes prosecutors don't have the same ability to deal with the state of mind of a victim and a person that's scared beyond sense of belief, has maybe previously victimized and they're in a situation.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think the prosecutors deal with victims of crimes all the time, and they also deal in the criminal milieu, which can skew a person's attitude toward life, I think, a little bit. But yes, I agree. And I would say, now that I'm here, that Representative Fairclough asked me last time I was here to look at what other states did, as I recall. And I did call the Prosecutors Association in Florida, which has a stand your ground statute that is similar to this, although it's a little bit different. And of course, this is a prosecutor that I spoke to who said that it has caused additional hearings and additional use of resources because they have pre-trial hearings on the self-defense issue. But it's very hard to quantify, to put a number on these hearings.
Representative Costello?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, Representative Gattenberg.
Is Mr. Steiner still on?
Mr. Steiner, are you available still?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Jeff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Steiner, Ms. Carpinetti is talking about from the perspective of the prosecutor, and you are the other side of the table, the public defender, thank you. Is from your perspective, do you see increased workload on your side? Do you see more people that have been your clients in the past that would use this if they could?
Through the chair, Representative Gunberg, I see this a little bit differently. I think the duty to retreat and the justification to use self-defense are essentially mutually exclusive. If you can do one and retreat, you don't have the authority to use self-defense. If you do, you can't retreat. And as a result, ultimately, I don't see it as having a significant impact. This issue is on the table in a case of self-defense and available for argument at all times. And, we're dealing with situations where somebody has used this force. And whether or not this is an additional available defense or not, it isn't really going to change in terms of the outlay of the case. I mean, this just arguably takes away the state's ability to charge under these circumstances. But again, I don't think it's going to have a significant impact either way. And I submitted a zero FISCA mode as a result.
Joe Gettenberg.
That's all. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Steiner, if there's less prosecutions, let's say my concern, it's anecdotal. It's been mentioned by some members of this body, we don't have a law school in Alaska, so people come from other venues. And so you have someone from New York City via Harvard shows up without really an understanding. They've been raised in an environment where guns aren't even legal. They certainly have something that you'd be convicted for in another venue. If there's ambiguity in the law in an overworked department, even to be initially charged is an incredible burden for somebody that's already been a victim, and it's really a grinder of a process that's hard to recover from. And that's, this is just intuitively, I would think that I think there would actually be savings on both ends, not doing the prosecutions, which depends on the venue. You'd get a different verdict in downtown Juneau versus in the Palmer Courthouse, as we've witnessed. There's an ambiguity within our legal system. I think that's a little bit subjective, but I think it's accurate. I know if I was on a weapons charge, I'd rather be tried in Nome than in Juneau, for example. But I think Representative Dugan characterized that. If the people in Nome feel safe in shooting distance, and that's a different value judgment, and that's what we're talking about. A lot of these prosecutors may bring in value judgments, and that's my personal testimony. That's my personal feelings on this. So we're probably going to have less costs on both prosecution and defense. It's a behavior modifier, but that's... Mr. Steiner, I guess my question to you in that roundabout ramble is there a possibility you would have less work if there weren't prosecutions on these?
Mr. Chairman, it's really tough to say. I don't think it's actually going to have a significant impact either way, because frankly, for the state to prove that somebody had a duty to retreat is very difficult on its own. Again, it's part and parcel of the self-defense claim itself. So in either case, the state would have the burden. So I don't see it as changing, you know, decisions by a defendant about whether or not to go to trial. As to whether or not it causes the prosecution not to charge, I think it's such a close call, I can't be sure that it would go one way or the other.
But that was a subjective question. That was a subjective question. I wouldn't have expected to lower your department's budget because you were doing less work, because you were going to have more work that you can do under any scenario. So I know often people are reluctant to say we're going to spend less money, but that's not what I was trying to seek.
Sure, Mr. Chairman. I was actually trying to get at that issue. I mean, theoretically, it'd have a tendency to reduce the pressure. It's so closely tied, I'm not sure what impact that would have.
Any other questions for Mr. Steiner? We'll have you hang online, sir.
We've got one more.
We have on off-net Paul Brown. Mr. Brown, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead and identify yourself for the record, and why don't you tell us? I've probably been remiss in asking where folks are from.
My name's Paul Brown.
We can't hear you, sir. We still can't hear you.
Really?
Okay, there we go.
Okay. Okay, Paul Brown from Fairbanks. And I'm in support of House Bill 80. Not sure what else I should say. I don't believe it goes nearly as far as some of the other no-retreat laws in the nation. But it's a step forward in the right direction.
Thank you. That was very succinct. And you're noted in support.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Is there anybody else online? Well, we'll go ahead and we won't close public testimony. We'll continue discussion and get to an end point to this, which would be a motion to move it out if there's not anything. But Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure that this question should be directed to, but what is it that you're saying when you say,
what is it that's being said here when the law says any place where the person has a right to be? So how is a right to be defined?
Mr. Shattuck.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dugan, Breck Shattuck.
Speak up just a little bit.
Breck Shattuck, staff to Representative Mark Newman. Through the chair, Representative Dugan. I think a little earlier there was testimony from Brian Judy about that issue. If you were walking across the parking lot in a public place from the mall with a handful of groceries, and it was late at night, you had a right to be there. It's a public place. And so in the middle of an open parking lot where there was no cover, perhaps it was unreasonable to suspect that you could reasonably retreat. And so you would have to stand your ground and protect yourself. There's been other testimony or questions asked in other committees about I'm an individual, I'm invited to a party on a date, and I'm therefore legally able to be there. And I leave that location, and I get into my vehicle, make a phone call home, and I walk back in. Am I still legally there? And it was kind of discussed that, yes, you would be. You were originally invited, and so you had a right to be there. As opposed to an individual who was perhaps walking across a piece of a corner lot that was empty, and the individual was cutting across that lot to go home. Would you not be legally able to be there and consequently not able to have a self-defense, use self-defense as a defense? Even if it was marked as private property and there had been public traffic across that, if you were not in the act of breaking in, if you were not in the act of committing some other crime on that, Alaska statutes talk about the distinction between the burden that a prosecution has and the burden that a defendant has. If you were walking across that, cutting across that property, and somebody accosted you there, and you used self-defense in that situation, then from cases that we read, for example, DeGroot versus the United States in the Ninth Circuit Court, 1935, they identified that a person might, in the defendant's position, be found to be, okay, questionable, not beyond a reasonable doubt, but reasonable doubt in the jury's mind. And so that individual might have at least met the level of saying, I had a right to be there, I had a right to use self-defense, as opposed to prosecutions had to reach a much higher level, and that was beyond a reasonable doubt. And so the question as to whether or not what identifies it as a place you have a right to be would be typically things that were public, typically places like your supermarket, the parking lot of the supermarket, a public road, any of those sorts of places would be places that you had a right to be, or someplace that you were invited.
Thank you. Did you achieve clarity, sir?
I did not.
Okay, I was checking your facial expression.
No.
I kind of knew that halfway through.
I don't.
But you were polite about it.
Yeah. I tried to be, Mr. Chairman. If this is not a term of art or a term of law, I don't know if it's a term of law, but if it's not a term of law, then it's subject to interpretation. And if it's subject to interpretation, then I need to know what that interpretation most commonly would be, always understanding that anything can be interpreted, even two lawyers might have a difference of opinion about it.
You need any lifelines, Mr. Shattuck? Or do you want to take this one?
If the Department of Law wants to further define what public is, then that is fine with me.
This is Annie Carpinetti again. You have a right to be any place where you're not trespassing. This is how we would interpret it. So if you're trespassing on somebody else's land, you would still have a duty to retreat. You could still use deadly force in self-defense, but you would have a duty to retreat. If you're on your own land, you don't have a duty to retreat. You're in your own home or in your own office building. There's no duty under our law to retreat at all in those places.
And if we're in the public domain, then, that is to say, it's not private land, it's not my land,
it's everybody's land, so everybody has a right to be there. So
you're okay with that interpretation.
Under this bill,
yeah,
you don't have to retreat in a public park, even if you can do so with complete safety to yourself and others under this bill.
Hmm.
Thank you.
Until Guttenberg. Why don't you just stay there?
Yeah, thank you. You're trying to just constantly focus this down. You know, some things have happened in my life, including a jury where we used the necessity defense on somebody. You know, a woman was in imminent danger, and she was drunk driving to get away from a situation, and the jury, you know, we went back to deliberate. It's like, there's no question about this. She had a defend herself by getting away. She didn't have a firearm or anything like that. But, I keep that in perspective when I'm looking at things like this. But, so are you saying, even trespassing, you have a right to defend yourself? I mean, you don't make that. Somebody jumps out of the woods in a wooded lot, or, in the woods, you don't know if you're on private property or public property, or if you're on some where you're at. You still have the right to defend yourself.
Through the chair, yes, Representative.
Right. So, we're assuming that people like this gentleman in the car incident, you don't have the opportunity to make a split second decision in most of these cases. You just have, you're under threat, you or your family, under imminent threat. You just have the right to defend yourself, period, regardless of where you are.
Through the chair, that's correct. There's no duty to retreat unless you know you can do so in complete safety to yourself and others. And that gentleman was on a public street. He, of course, had the right to be there.
So we're just changing, does this bill, and just... We're trying to focus down what it exactly it does. It just takes away a split second decision you normally wouldn't be making anyway, from my perspective.
This bill, our current law says you don't have to make that split second decision. If you're frightened for yourself or your family or people around you, you have the right to use deadly force in defense of yourself or others and no duty to retreat unless you know. And that's subjective. You know you can do so in complete safety to yourself and others. This bill says that you don't have to retreat at all if you have a right to be there.
If I a little leeway, in that Big Lake case where those two, I think it was a few years ago, where I think two people broke into a house and the owner came out and chased them away and he shot them. And they were retreating. And he was acquitted. Mm-hmm. Would this bill have said what? Would this bill have changed anything?
I don't, through the chair, that's an interesting question because I think that case is a concern to a lot of people. He was in a place where he had a right to be. He had absolutely no duty to retreat.
Right.
On the other hand, they were running away. So they were charged. He was charged with homicide in those cases.
Right.
I don't know that this bill wouldn't have made any difference because he was in a right to, he was already in a place where he had a
right to be.
Right to be, and well, he had a right to be. Not only that, but he was in his a place where he worked or a place where he had no duty to retreat at any rate.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know that this bill would have made a difference in that particular case.
Would it have changed? Would it perhaps change the attitude in the prosecutor's office with the statute on the books on whether or not that would have been a viable case to prosecute?
Mr. Chairman, I would like to talk to the prosecutors who did that because I think there was a fairly, those two men who were, or boys, I think they were young men, were shot in the back as they were
Army
running
young
away.
Men.
Yes, they were shot in the back as they were running away. But I would like to, I would be happy to talk to them and ask them if they think that would have made a difference, this bill would have made a difference in their decision.
Representative Fairclough.
Mr. Speaker, I know that we're.
I'm just a mere chairman.
Mr. Speaker. Mr. Chairman, I wouldn't ask this normally, but we had someone testify about an incident with a car, and we know that there is road rage on occasion, too often, maybe in other cities a little bit more than ours. But I live in the larger city of Anchorage, and so we see road rage going back and forth to the community of Eagle River, at least I have, on a frequency that I wouldn't want others to have to experience it. Can you tell me, in the situation that we heard earlier today where it was described to us that someone was on the highway going the right direction and someone on the highway going the wrong direction, what if the situation was reversed and the person that was in jeopardy of the person was in a place that they didn't have a right to be? They were going the wrong way on a road, and they had a right to be in their car, and now we have someone that it was an honest mistake. I've had someone turn in oncoming traffic before on me on a one-way road where they're absolutely coming straight at me, and there are no signs facing their directions, and all the signs are mine. Are going my way. So they're in the wrong. They're coming down a street that they shouldn't be on. What if the person in there is attacked? Do they have a right to still use physical force to defend themselves when they don't have a right to be where they're at in that kind of a location?
Mr. Chairman, that's really an interesting question, because you certainly have a right to be on a public street.
Right.
You don't have a right to be going the wrong. I guess you don't have the right to be going the wrong direction. That's a traffic infraction. That's really a tough question.
Mr. Chairman, I don't mean to make it complex. I just wanted to know if people get in a fight at that point, that person still is defending themselves, so they don't really have a right to retreat. But I was switching the person that described to us a very action that put his life in jeopardy, and the other person's life could be put in jeopardy if he would have went out and tried to attack him. So either way, the violence was wrong going either direction. But I'll let it go, Mr. Chairman. We can come up with what ifs all over the place. I support the legislation moving from committee. I do believe people have a right to defend themselves, and I want to make it as least restrictive as possible for a person to be able to defend themselves or their families in an unsafe situation. The Congresswoman comes to mind as far as a public place that I wish somebody would have been a carrier of a weapon to defend people that were aimlessly killed. Anyway, Mr. Chairman, I'll yield.
Well, this is the Finance Committee, so we'll go to the fiscal notes. But it's probably good we had the discussion. We've discussed your indeterminate fiscal note. That's the one dated, let's see. Eyes are so bad here. 325-2011, is that the correct version?
I believe so. It's the
okay, I just wanted to make sure because there was a previous one. And Public Safety has a zero fiscal note. Does Public Safety want to put any comments on the record regarding the fiscal note? So we have the two, the zero and the indeterminate. Do we have any more public testimony? Last call. We'll go ahead and close public testimony. We've had the discussion on the fiscal notes and discussion on the substance of the bill. We had a mini judiciary meeting. So, Representative Costello.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 80, version 27-LS0190/A, with accompanying fiscal note and individual
notes.
And individual committee recommendations from the committee.
Is there any objection? Hearing none, the bill's moved out of committee. I thank everybody for their work late in the evening after a pretty much nonstop day. Thank you very much for allowing the public to participate, the ones that did come out. Thank you to those folks that were listening in from Alaska and the fellow that's called in from California with the NRA. Members will stay around just long enough to sign the reports. Tomorrow morning we have confirmation hearings for Brian Butcher, Commissioner of Department of Revenue, the mental health trustees, and the University of Alaska Board of Regents. And then in the afternoon, continuing legislation. With that, if there's no other questions, thank you again, everybody, and we are adjourned.
I certainly did not expect.